Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Tour de France enters its final week in the mountains of the Pyrenees. Today, despite recent doping scandals, this 20-stage road race remains one of the premier sporting events in Europe, followed increasingly by many Americans as well. Today we hear about the story of one of its most remarkable winners. Gino Bartali won the Tour in 1938 and again after the race resumed after World War II in 1948. This still remains the record for the longest time span between victories. But the remarkable part of the story was Bartali's life in between the victories. For much of the war, Bartali was a part of the Italian underground, serving as a courier shuttling forged documents for Jews hiding in Italy and protecting a family himself in one of his apartments. My guest today, Eileen McConnon, with her brother Andres, has written a fascinating account that not only encompasses Bartali's life, but life in fascist Italy, the early history of the Tour de France and road cycling, and a story of the resistance in Italy. The name of the book is Road to Valor, a true story of World War II Italy, the Nazis, and the cyclists who inspired a nation. She joins us today by phone to tell us about the remarkable story of Gino Bartali. Eileen McConnon, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Let me ask you how you and your brother first came across the story of Gino Bartali.
Gino Bartali and his amazing story first crossed our radar nearly 10 years ago. My brother was at the Tour de France that year, and he was cheering from the sidelines as Lance Armstrong was working his way to another victory. Lance at the time was 30 years old, which, if you can imagine, is considered old by cycling standards. And this elicited discussion among many of the fans and the press about other athletes who had won the race in their 30s. And one of the men that caught my brother's attention was Gino Bartali, who was one of the most famous Italian athletes of his era and who had won the Tour in 1938 and then again 10 years later in 1948 at the age of 34. And my brother was immediately fascinated by how Bartali had managed to stay at the top of his sport when World War II interrupted his career in those intervening 10 years. And at that time, I was in New York, and Andres gave me a call and talked about the Tour, and he mentioned Bartali, and our conversation turned to exactly this question of how did Bartali spend the wartime years. I did a bit of research and found a short mention in an Italian newspaper that Bartali had helped the Jewish community in Tuscany during World War II, and I was intrigued to find more and started our research really started at that point. And once we discovered that Bartali had in fact helped the resistance and transported false identity documents that were hidden in the frame of his bicycle, and these were used by Jews who needed them to evade the Nazis, we realized the story had this combination of a sports underdog combined with a surprising saga of a secret wartime hero. And we realized we wanted to develop this character and his life story into a book.
Well, it is a fascinating book where you tell not only the story of Bartali, but also this sort of story of pre-war Italian fascism. You're telling the story of the Tour de France, as well as the story of resistance during the war, and of course his comeback in 1948. What's fascinating to me was apparently he was a pretty frail fella for having this incredible stamina to not only win the Tour de France several times, but also winning road rallies in his native Italy, the Tour of Italy. He had this incredible stamina despite being sort of small of stature and also being fairly frail. He had several bouts of pneumonia.
You're right, Rich. Bartali was quite a scrawny child actually growing up, and one of the reasons he didn't follow his father's profession, which was a day laborer, which was heavy-duty manual work, was that because he was so frail, his father didn't think he could handle it. And so it's quite amazing when he started to show early success on the bicycle, and I think, you know, it was partly to do with he had an incredible endurance and was able to, I think, surprise his rivals and power past them on the mountains. But he also had this strong conviction in his own strength and a dedication to sort of building up each aspect of a cyclist's kind of repertoire of skills, whether it's, you know, lasting on the bicycle for many hours a day, you know, trying out all sorts of different food combinations. And he even, later in his career, in 48, smoked, if you can imagine. His doctors recommended it because his heart rate was quite low, as happens when you're a serious athlete, but at the time they thought, you know, athletes, your heart needs to beat quickly for you to perform optimally. So they said, why don't you try smoking a few cigarettes before races, which he followed this advice very religiously.
You know, it was also fascinating to hear about their training regimens, too, because, you know, nowadays we know that it's about eating lots of calories, but a light diet, they would fill up on, like, really heavy steaks and proteins, which, of course, we now know is really terrible for actually high-level aerobic activity.
That's right, and the nutrition was one of, you know, many elements that was so interesting to research, because at the time there really wasn't the sort of sports science and nutrition that we have today, and they were basically, you know, experimenting, kind of taking notes themselves. Their team coaches would take notes, and then they'd sort of improve upon that, and at the time it was interesting. I think that steak, for instance, which is something that they love to consume before big stages, you know, is such a rare kind of food item for many poor villagers like Bartoli, as his family was, and, you know, for many, many kind of cyclists who came from humble backgrounds. So it was seen as, you know, high-quality food that you'd have on special occasions. So if you're racing a big race, that was a, you know, a special occasion. So you needed to have the kind of most fortified food possible. And at the time, they thought that was a big red steak.
Yeah. Give us a sense of how important cycling was during this particular time. Cycling at that time was far bigger in Europe than it was in the United States. And even today in the United States, unless you're a devoted cyclist, you might pay attention to the Tour de France once or twice during this month. But really, you don't really think about cycling. In this day and age, Bartoli was every bit as famous as Lance Armstrong, and probably more so in Europe, wasn't he?
He certainly was. And cycling in Europe, it was, you know, it was the most popular sport of the summer. And Bartoli, at the height of his fame, you know, he was as well known in Europe as, say, Joe DiMaggio in the United States, where, you know, baseball obviously is incredibly popular. Cycling had that similar reach across Europe. And, you know, beyond the professional athletes, everyday people used bicycles wherever they went. You know, in the early years, up until the 40s, there were many more bicycles on the road, for instance, than cars. So it's something that every person sort of understood, because, you know, from the school child to the housewife, everyone used a bicycle. The office clerk, you know, you used a bicycle wherever you went. And the races were often these huge events that people attended, because it gave you this sort of chance to follow your heroes. And it was sort of a ticket out of many people's, you know, more kind of their lower income standings.
What was also interesting to me was in the pre-war years, how fascist authorities really controlled Bartoli. I mean, even though he was not a fascist at all. In fact, he was probably anti-fascist. He was very canny about not... He spoke by what he didn't say rather than what he did say, I think you read in the book. But it was interesting to see how fascist authorities in sport basically controlled individual athletes. I found that really interesting.
You're right, and the fascist officials in Italy controlled every element of an athlete's training, which races they were allowed to race. And they really felt that they wanted to, and they tried to use athletes and their successes as a sort of propaganda tool for fascism abroad. And this made it put athletes like Bartoli in a difficult position, because he certainly did not like what they were doing, but they also wielded such power that if he spoke out too vocally, there was great danger that it posed. They could, you know, completely ruin his career, but even worse, there was another cyclist who spoke out against the fascists and one day mysteriously appeared killed at the side of a road, and, you know, no one knew what had happened. And so Bartoli had to be careful in how he navigated the fascist regime, because he wanted to be able to continue cycling, but he also was, you know, strongly opposed to what they were doing.
And that's the thing we forget about Italy. We think of that as resistance to the regime or speaking out against the regime as having negative consequences in Nazi Germany, but not necessarily in fascist Italy. But in fact, you detail a whole line of folks that, because Bartoli was famous, he had access to a lot of these people. And when they spoke out against the regime, all of a sudden they'd find themselves dying in mysterious circumstances.
That's right. I think that, you know, early in the war, the fascists posed a significant threat to many, you know, ordinary Italians, and especially anyone who didn't like the direction that the government was moving. And then once the Nazis occupied Italy, this is midway through World War II, 1943, we're talking about, you know, ordinary Italians had to both deal with the fascists who they already didn't like, but then the new kind of ominous force of the Nazis who were even more fierce.
you know, even though he was really famous, this relationship with the Italian authorities was pretty interesting. When he won the Tour in 1938, by what he didn't say, he didn't thank Mussolini and the fascists profusely. Mm-hmm. When he came back to Italy, it was like, you know, there was no celebrations.
You're correct, Rich. The celebrations after Bartoli's 1938 win were almost non-existent, and I think they were a direct response to the fact that he hadn't done what was he was expected to do when he won the Tour. You know, at this moment, if any athlete had a major sports victory, it was expected that you would thank Mussolini, you'd thank the fascists, and instead Bartoli just thanked his fans. And in fact, the day after he won the Tour, he went and gave his victory bouquet. He put it at the foot of the Madonna in a church in Paris. And I think this gesture, you know, angered the fascists greatly, so that when Bartoli returned to Italy, the fascists controlled the press at this point as well. You know, there's very little made of the fact that, you know, one of the greatest athletes of the moment had returned to Italian soil.
How did you learn about his true story? Because I would think in the 20s and 30s with a propagandist press, you really couldn't depend on press accounts of the period. How did you go about learning about who Bartoli really was?
That's a good question. For our research, we spent a significant amount of time in Italy and France as well, in interviewing some of those closest to Bartoli, his widow, his son, many of his teammates, as well as others who'd been impacted by him, including even a former president of Italy who'd been a fan of Bartoli. And, you know, we were able to fill in the details of what had happened to him, especially during that period when the fascist press controlled the media, through talking to these eyewitnesses, people who'd been there at the time. You know, and there were some external press accounts, kind of the French, they actually reported the fact that no one, you know, showed up to celebrate Bartoli when he returned to Italy. So there were a few voices outside of Italy that realized what was going on and had commentary from the moment as well that helped us to bring to life that moment.
Hmm. Another admirable thing about Gino Bartoli is he was true to his friends, and this certainly showed up in the Goldenberg family, who he knew as a young boy. And, of course, during the war, he was friends with the Cardinal of Florence. He officiated at his wedding because he was a famous athlete. But during the war, the Cardinal calls him and asks him to work in the resistance. He'd been pretty apolitical, even despite these sort of snubs of the fascists. He basically said, I'm not getting into politics in any shape or form.
That's right. Bartoli really wanted to focus on his cycling. He felt that was the one thing he was good at. And, you know, politics wasn't something that interested him. But by the fall of 1943, when the Nazis occupied Italy, you know, it was a moment when Bartoli couldn't, you know, politics was everywhere, and Bartoli couldn't avoid that. And he got a call from the Cardinal of Florence, who, as you mentioned, was a friend of his, a mentor. They'd known each other through Catholic circles for many years. And the Cardinal had called to ask, because there were a whole number of Jewish refugees in Florence who, at that point, desperately needed help, and they needed shelter, they needed false identity documents, because at this point, the Nazis were beginning to send people away to different camps. And so Bartoli was asked because he had a reason to be on some of the roads in the surrounding area of Tuscany, because he'd been training on them as a champion before the war. He was asked to sort of participate as a messenger, almost like a postman, bringing different identity documents, which he hid in the frame of his bicycle, and he brought them to various different villages and towns in the region to different Jews who were hiding and needed those documents preciously.
Yeah, and how did he actually conceal these documents?
So he would roll them up like a scroll, and then if you can imagine taking off the seat of your bicycle, there's a hollow frame that's a sort of a vertical frame, and so he'd roll them up and put them in that hollow frame, and he'd move back and forth between a few different towns. A town near Florence called the CD was where there's a counterfeit identity printer who was making these documents, and so often Bartoli would travel between Florence and the CD, whether bringing photographs from a new batch of Jewish refugees who'd arrived, he'd bring the photographs, those would be inputted into the documents, and then he'd sort of transport those documents back.
It was interesting, he, at the very beginning of the war, he did serve in the army for a while, and he convinced his superior that as a messenger, he would be better riding a bike than a scooter. And so this was part of the cover too, wasn't it?
That certainly was. He was conscripted early in the war, like many Italians, and he, you know, reluctantly kind of participated, but he was able to negotiate that allowance, that instead of I think the others would have gone perhaps on motorized scooters. He was able to use his bicycle to perform his duties as a messenger. And that was another reason where when he was traveling the roads later in the war, doing some of the work for the resistance, he had this double alibi of this previous national champion, but also this former military messenger. So people would, wave him on, and given that he didn't have significant bags or weapons, they were looking for kind of people who were part of the resistance, sort of carrying weapons. He was reasonably unsuspicious, I suppose, to the folk at the checkpoints.
And not only was he transporting documents, but he was also sheltering a family,
That's right.
His childhood.
The other role that Bartley played during the war was sheltering a family of four. He knew the father from childhood. They'd been friends, and when the Nazis occupied Italy, the father reached out to Bartley. And because Bartley was a little more wealthy than most other Italians, he'd enjoyed success as a cyclist. He had not only his own home, but he owned other apartments and had stakes in other residences. So he was able to find first an apartment for the family, and then when the situation got even more dangerous, he moved them to an underground basement where, thanks to Bartley's help, they survived the war.
My guest today is Eileen McConnon. She and her brother, Andres McConnon, have written the book Road to Valor, a true story of World War II Italy, the Nazis, and the cyclists who inspired a nation, which tells the story of Gino Bartali, who was a champion cyclist in the last Tour de France, really before the war, and won the Tour de France in 1938 and again in 1948, but had this secret life during the war where he was a part of the Italian resistance. And really, where he came from, he was an incredibly devout Catholic. In fact, he would dedicate a lot of his wins to the church, wouldn't he?
His cycling wins. He did, and
his
religion was so prominent that one of his nicknames was the pious runner, Il Pio. And he was known for actually often racing with a little medallion of the Virgin Mary on his bicycle.
There's also an incident in the book where he was actually suspected of perhaps aiding the resistance pretty late in the war. And it was sort of the commandant of Florence, who was, I guess you'd call him a war criminal or certainly a police official. And he was actually picked up for about a week.
That's correct. Bartley was arrested and imprisoned for a very frightening several days. This was by one of the fascist police chiefs in Florence. And, at first Bartley didn't know why he had been brought in, so he was terrified that his work either for the cardinal bringing documents or his help sheltering the Goldenberg family had been discovered. And this would have been very problematic because the Jews at this time were declared enemies of state. So if you were caught helping enemies of state, the punishment was very severe. You could be tortured, you could certainly be killed, you could be sent to camps. But it turned out amazingly that the fascist police chief didn't in fact have enough evidence or didn't have any evidence of this more serious work that Bartley had done. All he had was some evidence that Bartley had helped gather food and supplies for Italian refugees who had gathered in the Vatican. And at this time, if you can imagine, as many Italian cities were bombed, there were a lot of regular Italians who were moving around the country or had to leave their homes because they needed supplies and food elsewhere. So Gino had also helped some of these people, and there'd been the fascist police chief had got a bit of evidence of this, which was why he was brought in. But luckily, he didn't have evidence of his more serious work. Otherwise, the consequences would have been very dire.
Yeah, that's one of the interesting things about this book. When we think of how the church reacted to fascism and fascism in general, Nazis and fascists, we think of it as sort of this sort of uneasy accommodation. You paint a very different picture of how the church reacted to fascism in your particular book.
I think there are many individuals who, were religious who did stand up. And we focused in our narrative on Bartley and some of those that he interacted with who did behave very courageously. There's the Cardinal of Florence that we talked about, who was a known anti-fascist. And there's a very prominent monk in Assisi as well who risked his life on several occasions. And I think, there were many instances of everyday religious clergy, who saw what was happening and did what they could within their realms of influence. And, Bartley happened to connect with those who were courageous and stood up, and they were able to, help as a result.
Of course, the second part of the story, after this amazing story already, he's a great athlete, he helps in the resistance through the war, and after the war, he resumes cycling. And imagine to be of the age where he was a prime athlete before the war and still be able to compete after the war. And I think of just the privations. He couldn't have been eating a healthy diet during the war. He lost most of his money. By the time the war ended, he really had to go back to cycling because he had no money left. I can't imagine that he would have the strength to complete a Tour de France, much less win one, in 1948.
I think that precisely that strength and resilience in Bartoli impressed us because, as you point out, he had been at his prime before the war. So when he returned in 1948 to the Tour de France, he was 10 years older than many of his competitors. But I think that he also, the return to the Tour had been one of the things that had helped him survive the war, the dream of sort of getting back to cycling. But it wasn't an easy race, but for the first half of the race, he actually fared quite poorly, and people saw this, the media, even his coach saw this as proof that, he was just simply too old to make a real go of it, and he even earned the nickname. They called him the old man because they, saw him racing against some younger competitors and thought, and laughed, basically, that he didn't have a chance. But in an amazing performance in one of the stages midway through the Tour, where he was more than 21 minutes, if you can imagine, behind the race leader, he kind of came back and made up most of that advantage. And the conditions were wretched. There was snow and sleet. It's one of the most gruesome stages of the Tour. But he was able to make a dramatic comeback that set him on course to win the 1948 Tour.
And he was an incredible rider in the mountains. You describe his techniques as it was unusual for that time and era, as the way he would approach riding.
That's right. Bartoli was known as a force in the mountains, and part of it was because he had this unusual technique that, unlike some riders who are very smooth and they make a decisive move, whether to be sitting or standing in the saddle, he would kind of confuse his fellow competitors by kind of standing up in the saddle, sitting down, but also varying his speed, which with riding, there's a whole lot that is tremendously important with your cadence and rhythm. And so what he would do is he would break away from the group, kind of baiting others to follow him. If anyone dared to follow him, we'd often be tired out by it. And he would kind of do this back and forth where he kind of break away from the group, let someone catch up, and then kind of sink back into the group. And for the rest were unable to basically survive this sort of grueling technique. And it was his secret to his success.
As you wrote the book, you sort of discussed the fact that you knew he'd helped the underground during the war. He was a great athlete before the war, great athlete after the war. But I gather the sense is you just learned more about his life. It was more and more surprising. What was the most surprising thing you've learned about Bartoli in the course of writing this book?
I think the book had many wonderful surprises. And I think, how widely he was appreciated and how many people he impacted in Italian society was probably the greatest surprise. And whether it's a chance to interview a former Italian president who had, been a big fan of his, to interviewing the surviving member of the family that he saved, who no one had kind of discovered before, and Bartoli hadn't even really talked about himself, that was quite amazing because we had the chance to interview this gentleman in Tel Aviv. He was 11 years old during the war. Now he's a gentleman in his 70s. And when writing the book and kind of trying to bring to life the role that Bartoli played during World War II, it really helped to have a personal account to be able to put a face on the experience of Jews in Italy during World War II. And it's, one thing to say that he helped a community, but it's quite another to be sitting in front of someone who, can tell you that this man saved my family's life, and here were the difficulties of this era as I saw them with my two eyes.
And that was, I'm sure, a really great moment in the course of writing this book. The other thing you wrote is, during the war when he's working with the cardinal and this monk who was housing an atheist printer and the cyclist and how when the printer finally met Bartoli, this is how secret it was. Nobody knew who else was involved, but he happened to see Bartoli. He goes, wow, if Bartoli's involved, I guess I can take my chances. I thought that was a really interesting reaction.
Yeah, I think that was a powerful, when we discovered that interview, we realized it could be a powerful scene in the book because, as you point out, for the continuing functioning of this network, it's actually very important that every member knew as few other members as possible because at this point, when people could be arrested, if you were arrested, you were tortured, and if you, revealed the other members, you could put at risk the whole network and all the people that were being sheltered. So the printer didn't know about Bartoli's role for several months of the operation. And it was, in fact, at one point when he was at a particularly low point and feeling terrified, where he felt he'd nearly been caught and was ready to kind of resign from the effort, realized that it was just too dangerous, but that he spotted Bartoli bringing documents. And, you know, it was the fact that there's a national champion, you know, someone that he admired, who had also joined forces to help for this cause, that, you know, helped him kind of continue in the work that he was doing.
Well, do you feel like you got a true picture of Bartoli? Because even today, when you read accounts of athletes or celebrities, you know, it is a very public image. And going back that far, do you feel like you got a true picture of who Bartoli was?
I think we got close. I mean, as you point out, I think it's hard when someone has passed away to get a true picture. And in fact, even if they're still alive, you know, they'll share some stories when you interview them. But, you know, of course, they're not going to share every last one. We were lucky in that we were able to meet with some of the people, such as his widow and his son, people who knew him closely, as well as the fact that he had written a few autobiographies as well, that at least gave a good perspective on his cycling psyche and his attitude. So, you know, you get close and you do your best with the materials that you have, but I think any writer will admit that it's, you can't really get 100% inside someone else's character, but you do your best.
My guest is Eileen McConnon, who, along with her brother, Andres McConnon, has written Road to Valor, a true story of World War II, Italy, the Nazis, and the cyclists who inspired a nation. The story of Gino Bartali, who won the Tour de France in 1938 and then again in 1948, but who worked in the underground during the war. And I have to ask you the last question. Is the process of co-writing with a sibling, I imagine that could be very interesting, and it could work really well, and maybe at other times, maybe not so well. How is this the first time you've ever worked together to write a book?
This is our first book together, yeah. And I think we luckily both found that actually working with a sibling was wonderful. I think having a co-author generally can be terrific because you have someone else who takes a first look at anything you've drafted and can offer you candid feedback. And I think as siblings, too, you have a good relationship because you know each other for many years. So you have a good sense of each other's strengths and weaknesses, but you're also, or at least we were lucky, we were able to be very frank with each other in terms of when we each of us had drafted something, if we thought one part worked or it didn't, because we knew that we, you know, our relationship would need to last beyond the book. We'd be eating together at many family meals in the years to come, so we didn't want to fracture that, so we kind of made the relationship work and had a lot of fun writing the book together.
And he's a historian. Your background is a journalist, so I think that actually works pretty well, actually.
Yeah, we were lucky. I think the book was certainly better as a result of having two of us on it.
The name of the book is Road to Valor. Eileen McConnon, thanks very much for joining us.
Rich, thanks so much for having me.
Eileen McConnon speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. She and her brother, Andres, are the authors of Road to Valor, a true story of World War II Italy, the Nazis, and the cyclist who inspired a nation. It's published by Crown. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent shows, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.